Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 303, recorded Monday, June 26th, 2017. Don Dodge. Triangulation is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/triangulation. And by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software used by over 10 million small business owners. You should be using it. Try it free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the smartest people in the business. A little change in the way we do triangulation, you might have noticed. Maybe not. Of course, I've been on vacation, and I want to thank Jason Howell and Megan Maroney for filling in for me. But we like that so much, we're going to keep doing that. So Megan, Jason, and I will work in rotation to interview our guests on Triangulation, which is, I think, great because we're going to get new voices, new ideas, and it's still going to be the great, you know, kind of one-on-one interview show. The philosophy won't change, which is this is our chance to sit down for an hour and talk to some of the big thinkers in technology. My guest this week, Don Dodge, is a big thinker who's been around for a long time. And just his title today, developer advocate at Google, says a lot. But he has been, a developer advocate for many, many years. Sadly, he's trained in accounting. he decided quickly that it would be better to be in technology. You worked at when I look at the list, it's kind of almost who's who of great defunct technology companies. Digital Equipment, Forte Software, Alta Vista, Napster, mm-hmm. Groove Networks. Did you work with Ray Ozzie at Groove?
I did. I was vice president of product management and worked directly with Ray.
Oh, Ray's an amazing guy. And then, of course, Microsoft acquired Groove. Is that when you went to Microsoft?
Yes.
Director of Biz Dev for Microsoft's emerging business team. But I think, and somebody wrote this in an article about you, second only to Scoble as kind of the face of developer relations at Microsoft. And an evangelist.
At the time, yes.
Yeah. It's great to have you on. Thank you, Don, for joining us. I appreciate it. I thought it was very interesting. Gosh, I don't know where to start. I'm tempted to start back at the beginning. What did you do at DEC?
It's funny you should ask. I worked in the database systems group. So this was back in the day when Oracle, Ingress, Sybase, and then Digital had its own database system. And I worked with Chuck Rosewatt, who later went on to great things at Oracle. So I cut my teeth on technology in the boring database business.
Was it Route 128 crew on that whole?
Yeah.
And maybe boring, but at the time it didn't seem that boring. But this was, okay, so this must be after DBase. Because DBase owned the world, right? And then Oracle and Sybase come along, DEC comes along. These were enterprise DBase databases more?
Yeah, it was the enterprise stuff, not on PCs. So DBase was more of a PC thing.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about DBase, having written a lot of DBase code in my ill-spent youth. So from DEC, you went to Forte, another kind of enterprise play, I think, right?
Yeah, Forte Software was actually pretty interesting. This was before the days of Java. So there was no such thing as a runtime system like Java. You had to program for IBM systems or for Digital systems or for other Unix systems. It was a very complicated situation for developers back in the day. And Forte was the first company to do what is now Java runtimes. So they developed these runtime systems for each of the major stacks which allowed developers to just code in one native platform and then deploy on multiple platforms. So it was revolutionary.
At the time, yeah. Was that the 80s?
This 90s. Was the mid-90s. Early 90s, 92, 93, 94, before Java.
And before this thing called the internet.
Yes, it was. really. Got into that a little later.
Yeah, Alta Vista is an interesting... what did you do at Alta Vista?
I was a director of engineering at Alta Vista, and specifically for multimedia search. Image search, video search, music search.
So kids, before Google, kids, there were other places you could search for things. There was Yahoo, but I think bigger than Yahoo ended up being Alta Vista. In fact, it was really Google that put Alta Vista out of business. Well, they're not completely out of business, but kind of put the lid on Alta Vista.
Yes.
But we all used Alta Vista. I remember Dvorak saying in probably the late 90s or early 2000s, wow, I always ask people what search engine they use, and I know they're really with it if they say Google. Now it wouldn't work. That test wouldn't work, but the alternative was Alta Vista. Challenging, though, searching media.
Mm-hmm.
That's early days of recognition, right?
Right. It seems easy now, but it's hard to imagine. But back in those days, this was in 1994,
95. Wow. Oh, wow.
You couldn't search for images or video or music.
No.
It was not possible. So my group actually invented that technology and is still in use today at Yahoo.
No kidding. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it was an interesting thing because we had to figure out how to recognize an image or a video because there weren't tags back in the day or there weren't the kind of metadata that you needed around music or video or images to be able to identify them. So we had to use all the information available to us to try to figure out what it was. Wow. And of course, porn and spam were pretty major challenges at the time.
Yeah, it wasn't just for search. It was also to eliminate stuff, keep stuff out of the database. Well, now I understand how you got to Napster, because actually the music search probably was a logical segue into Napster.
It was. That's how I got there. So the first thing we did was image search, being able to search for photos and pictures. Then we did video. And last, we did music. And as I was doing the music search, I was looking around to see what else was out there. And at the time, there was something called iMesh from Israel and Scour, which incidentally was Travis Kalanick's first company.
No kidding. So
it was, yeah. So I knew Travis back in 1994, 95. He was only 21 years old at the time, and Scour was his first company, and that was a music search business. And then the last one I found was Napster. And of all of the music search companies, Napster was the least well-known, but it was three blocks down the street from Alta Vista, so that's how I got to see them.
It's in a way, you can almost say there's a modern-day mafia of people who left Napster and these other businesses, that was an incubator. Because when you're in your early 20s, music's what really is interesting. And so that's where you're going to go.
There were some amazing names from that time. So I mentioned Travis Kalanick. He was at Scour.
Yeah.
Sean Parker and Sean Fanning.
Yep.
Also Jordan Ritter, who you had on your show a while ago.
Jordan's great. He's quite a character. And he's still kind of doing search in a way. He's image recognition, things like that.
So Sean Parker went on to do several startups after Napster, but one of them was hooking up with Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. And that's really what made him famous and made him rich.
Made him rich. he might have been famous already, thanks to Metallica. we're talking to Don Dodge, and I'm saving. We're going through the career tree. I didn't mean to do that walk your resume. I apologize, but I'm saving the best for last because I want to talk about Ray Ozzie, a guy you called one of the smartest guys you've ever met. I want to talk about Groove and coming to Microsoft and getting fired at Microsoft because I think that there's some interesting lessons that you learned there. And then of course, we'll talk about going to the Goog. which which is must be fun. You've been at Google for how long? A long time now.
8 years.
Wow. And internet that's a long time. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you're here, Don. I appreciate it. Our show today brought to you by my dinner last night, of all things. Actually, I didn't eat last night. It was a couple of nights ago. We made cannelloni from Blue Apron. It was so good. And then a delicious cucumber and butter lettuce salad with a dressing. Now, it's funny because Lisa doesn't like vinegar, but the dressing was a lemon and shallot dressing with a little olive oil in it that was amazing. And all of this is from something that came in a box on my doorstep, Blue Apron. Blue Apron's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. They are amazing. In fact, one of the things people say is, well, how could you, you wouldn't trust a food delivery service to deliver you perfect produce. And then I have to say, well, I know somebody who's figured this out, and that's Blue Apron. Every, it's among many other things that Blue Apron does, but every ingredient in that Blue Apron box looks just like that picture on the website. Perfect. Perfect. Everything is just at the peak of perfection, of ripeness. That's because probably they work with 150 local farmers, sustainable agriculture. They believe in creating a sustainable food system, so the meats are sustainably raised, the fish are. And by the way, all the meat and fish is fresh. They have great vegetarian recipes, too, if you're a vegetarian. They set the highest standard for ingredients. And it's fun because you're doing the cooking. So I like the, I've tried other services that where you pre-made meals, and it's just never any good. I don't care what they say. But when you get the fresh ingredients and you get the card, and within 40 minutes you're cooking, and the house fills with these amazing aromas. You know, I diced the shallots and marinated them in the lemon juice, and now your mouth starts watering because it feels. And then I'd never made cannelloni, and after I did it, and this is the most important part: you make the sauce from scratch, you make the cannelloni from scratch, and after you do it, you go, "Oh, I can do that. That was easy." So Blue Apron, they don't sell it this way, but I feel like it's like a little mini cooking school. And I love to cook, but if you've never cooked before, or even if you're an experienced cook, you'll work with new ingredients, new techniques, and you will, look at that, salmon and cilantro lime rice with fresh corn salsa. See, I would love, once you make what fresh corn salsa, you're going to know how to make that. And the nice thing is Blue Apron doesn't repeat, at least a year between repeating recipes. So you're probably not going to see that again, but you're going to know how to make it. Look at what that corn, go back, corn, lime, peach, and a serrano pepper. And that all comes in the box. And by the way, exactly what you need. Not more than you, not 4 ears of corn. Exactly what you need to make the recipe. Now, they say for two, but we always split it for three because we have Michael. And frankly, that works really well. There's always leftovers. If you're doing the family plan, that's for four. And they use more kid-friendly ingredients. Seared chicken and creamy pasta salad with summer squash and sweet peppers. Creamy shrimp rolls with quick pickles and sweet potato wedges. I mean, wow. Nothing like coming home and having that Blue Apron box on your doorstep. It costs less than shopping at the grocery store because they don't have the overhead. Less than $10 per person per meal. Never any waste, so you always get exactly what you need to make that delicious home-cooked meal. 40 minutes or less, they're healthful, they're delicious, there's no weekly commitment. You only get deliveries when you want them. You choose the recipes based on the menus each week and your dietary preferences and your tastes. 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States, and their freshness guarantee promises every ingredient in your delivery arrives perfect. Perfect and ready to cook, or they'll make it right. We have Blue Apron every week. We've never had a problem. It's always been amazing. Check out this week's menu at blueapron.com/triangulation and get your first three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping. blueapron.com/triangulation. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home cooked meals with Blue Apron. It's made me love cooking again, I have to say. Don Dodge is our guest. He's developer advocate for Google, and we were going through his checkered past. how did you get to know Ray Ozzie? How did you go to Groove? This was after Lotus, right?
Yes. Ray started Lotus Notes, and Lotus, of course, was a spreadsheet company, best known for spreadsheets.
Mitch Kapor, another great... New England, actually, Silicon Valley has this reputation, but really, a lot of amazing stuff came out of New England, including VisiCalc, as well as Lotus.
Right. Dan Bricklin.
Dan Bricklin.
And Bob Frankston.
Yep. Mitch. Yeah. Mitch is amazing. So Ozzy was doing Notes, which was a collab, for people who don't know, a collaborative email/database environment. It was file sharing. It was all the stuff that you do now, just kind of secondhand. I mean, second nature. But it was hard to do in those days, pre-internet days.
Very hard to do.
Yeah.
So he did Notes, which was a enterprise server-based kind of collaboration environment, file sharing, email, that sort of thing. And then he sold it to IBM and made a ton of money. And Ray wanted to do the next thing. So that was basically Lotus Notes in a peer-to-peer environment.
Oh, how interesting.
So it basically took the Lotus Notes model and took it off the enterprise server and put it on a peer-to-peer kind of environment and added things like file sharing and work groups and all this kind of thing. So it was revolutionary at the time.
Yeah. And now I understand their interest in you because of the database background, the peer-to-peer background at Napster.
Right.
It was
a perfect fit.
Yeah.
Because I started my career at Digital Equipment doing database systems, and it turns out Ray Ozzy was also there.
Oh, no kidding.
Many, many years ago. And then after having the database experience and then the Napster peer-to-peer experience, I sort of went from the dark side to the white side doing it for business and enterprise.
You wrote about working with Ray, and you said that people know him, of course. Everybody does know him. He became the CTO at Microsoft and is known as being this visionary and so forth. But you say he's also, people don't know how funny he is.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He's Bill Gates said Ray Ozzy is one of the 5 best programmers in the world.
Wow.
And coming from Bill Gates, that's very high praise. And he is brilliant, a brilliant programmer, a brilliant architect and visionary. He's a big picture guy. And basically, Microsoft acquired Groove Networks to get Ray Ozzy. Ray Ozzy took over for Bill Gates as chief software architect. That's what allowed Bill Gates to retire from Microsoft.
Do you think that was the plan when Microsoft acquired Groove?
That wasn't what they said, but that's absolutely what
Bill
it was.
Bill had it in mind. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Bill Gates wanted to retire.
I can't leave unless I have somebody I know and I can trust that's got the brains. And
that's right.
Ray Ozzy makes perfect sense. I have to ask what happened, because everybody had high hopes and thought, man, this is going to be very exciting. And nothing really happened, it seems like. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong. Well, one thing that you can say Ray Ozzy did was Microsoft Azure. So he saw the future. He saw that the cloud was going to be a big thing. And he invented Azure. So he went off and built his own little separate group and had the vision for cloud computing and Azure. And that has Ray Ozzy's fingerprints all over it. He was the architect.
You could argue that's Microsoft's biggest business. Certainly, the cloud is their biggest business these days.
But
at the time, Steve Ballmer was still running the joint.
Right. So it was an almost impossible situation. You had Bill Gates, the legend, and then you had Steve Ballmer, the CEO and co-legend. And then Ray coming in to try to be the chief software architect and visionary and move the company forward in many different directions. He certainly had the brain power and the vision and the gravitas to do that. But coming into Microsoft, where there were billionaire, brilliant business leaders in each of those segments, like Microsoft Office or SQL Server or Windows Server. These groups were gigantic multi-billion-dollar businesses on their own. So having someone come in from the outside and try to manage that and be the visionary for it was a nearly impossible job.
Yeah, and again, You were on the inside. We were all, you know, as a tech journalist on the outside, but it did look as if, in fact, I know you've seen the famous cartoon, which I have hanging on my wall at home. The artist sent it to me, of all the guns, the org charts for all the different companies, and Microsoft, it's every group pointing guns at each other. It was at that time, and I think a lot of credit to Satya Nadella. He seems to have reinvented it, but at that time, a very political organization.
Incredibly political and very powerful people. And that's just not Ray. He's not a political guy. He's not a sort of organizational guy that wants to build the big fiefdom and be a corporate guy. That's not who he is. He is a visionary, a brilliant computer scientist. He can see the future, but putting him in the Microsoft environment was a real challenge.
Here's the famous org chart. Amazon looking pretty hierarchical. Google looking like a cat's cradle. Everybody reporting to everybody else. Facebook even more of a network. And then, of course, Microsoft with different divisions, each pointing guns at one another. Actually, I like the last two, which is Apple, one person in the middle, everybody else revolving around that, and Oracle, which has a normal org chart, but it's tiny compared to the giant org chart for legal. I love having this, and I think I have to remember, is it Ray Avila who drew it? I have to thank the original artist, Joey Davila, that's right, who drew it, because it is very, very funny, and there's the Microsoft piece of it. That hurt Microsoft. I think it was one of the things that held Microsoft back for a long time.
Well, I think two things really hurt Microsoft. First was Bill Gates leaving. You can't underestimate the power of Bill Gates to attract talent and to keep people focused on the right things. The second thing that really hurt Microsoft was the consent decree. And that legally took the teeth out of Microsoft.
That's
and made them. Those two things together came together at about the same time.
Right.
Bill left a little bit after the consent decree, but Microsoft was never the same after that.
So in 98, the Department of Justice went after Microsoft. It was a very long litigation, went for 5 or 6 years, as I remember. And ultimately, Microsoft, by the way, at the same time, the EU also went after Microsoft. And ultimately, Microsoft had to agree to have somebody on premises keeping an eye on monopolistic practices. And why was a consent decree a problem for Microsoft?
You have to remember at that time, there was talk from the Justice Department and from the EU about breaking Microsoft up into 5 or 6 separate companies. And Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer fought that to the death. They did not want that to happen. But to avoid that happening, they had to agree to a bunch of terms which were in this consent decree. And it basically prevented them from doing business the way they always did, with all of the groups cooperating with each other, tie-ins, bundles. You might remember Internet Explorer, the web browser. Didn't exist. Netscape was first. And Internet Explorer got bundled with Windows, and instantly it became the biggest browser in the world. So that's why the Justice Department and Commerce goes after these monopolies, because they do bundles and tie-ups like this that prevent competition or damage competition.
Right.
So the consent decree really forced Microsoft to do business in a very different way and not do the tie-ups and bundles and get the synergies that they normally did. So it changed everything.
I mean, on the one hand, I'm not against antitrust actions. Monopolies do use their monopoly, and we see it all the time. We still see it today, to enter new markets and squash competition. But it was clear also that, I mean, this thing took so long that at least the way it works, or where it worked then, was so slow that it didn't match the pace that technology was operating at. And so you had weird things like that browser ballot in Europe where when you first installed Windows, you had to choose the installed browser. This was the EU's way of avoiding the Internet Explorer integration. And it was just not friendly to users and to customers. You're not saying, Don, that Microsoft needed to act monopolistically in order to succeed?
No, it just went in the other direction.
Too far the other way.
Too far the other way because of the consent decree. They didn't do things that they could or should have done.
Right.
And in fact, if you were at Microsoft and watching what Apple did and the bundles and tie-ups that Apple did, we're like, are you kidding me? How can they do this?
But you know why? 4% market share. That's why.
Yeah.
That's not an issue when you're not a monopoly.
Right. But from a technology point of view, if you look at the things that they did.
I understand. Yeah.
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 So that's what I'm saying. Microsoft couldn't do the normal things that they should have done and could have done because of the dissent decree. And if you looked at Apple and the things that they were doing, that's the way Microsoft used to operate. And it's a great thing. It results in some pretty amazing technology. But Microsoft basically had their hands tied behind their back.
Well, and if nothing else, spending the first decade of the 2000s fighting and then responding to this and having all the oversight has to have made it difficult to just conduct business as usual.
Oh, it absolutely did. Yeah. And by the way, an interesting side note, David Boies, the lawyer, was working for the Justice Department against Microsoft at the time.
Yeah.
And 10 years later, I'm at Napster, and David Boies is our lawyer for Napster, fighting against the record company. So it was an interesting turnaround.
Somebody's got to write a history of David Boies because he keeps showing up again and again in Silicon Valley cases on both sides. I was just reading his name the other day. I'm trying to remember what he's involved with now. I think in politics, right? He was involved.
He was the lawyer for Al Gore in the 2000s.
Oh, Theranos. Yeah. That's what it is. He's on the board and is the attorney for Theranos.
Oh, my God. He is a formidable man. He's a brilliant lawyer and amazing guy.
Chief counsel for Sony Pictures Entertainment when they got hacked over the interview a couple of years ago. He'd be a lead counsel for Oracle and it's against Google. That was the other one. He was standing up for Oracle in their suit over Java.
If I'm in trouble, I want David Boies as a lawyer.
no kidding. But you said the second problem was Bill Gates leaving. That's interesting. I mean, you mentioned Travis Kalanick. We're looking at Uber and 1,000 Uber employees saying you can't fire Travis. He's the heart and soul of the company. How hard is it a company to move on from a founder?
There are very few examples of companies that where the founder left. I'm talking about significant companies where the founder left and the company was better after.
Yeah.
Very, very rare. If you look at Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer or Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak or Larry Page and Sergey Brin or any of these companies that have these founders that are just iconic, visionary leaders, moving forward without them is incredibly difficult.
You mentioned one reason it's hard because somebody like Bill Gates attracts talent because people want to work with Bill Gates.
Right. Right. These guys are Pied Pipers and they want to work with the best people in the world. And Bill Gates was one of those. And you could argue that Travis was too. I've known Travis for 17 years, 18 years, maybe longer. He was only 21 years old at the time. But he's an amazing force of nature and, a smart guy and very aggressive guy and didn't recognize boundaries. And that's one of the traits of founders. They ignore boundaries. And most of the time when it's with technology, it's okay.
Right.
When it gets to personal things, it's not okay.
Right. maybe that's the, you know, you look at Steve Jobs, who also, I mean, had quite a reputation, but never in that way. Well, actually, I shouldn't even say that. But people wanted to work at Apple because they wanted to work for Steve, and they knew it was going to be hell. But they knew he would also bring the best out of them.
Yeah, I was on the bad end of a couple of conversations with Steve Jobs, and he is was a very intimidating, intimidating guy. He can be charming when he wants to be, and he can be a really tough bad guy when it suits him. Yeah. So he was good at both.
Yeah. To its credit, and I think a lot of credit to Satya Nadella, Microsoft seems to have turned that corner. Would you agree?
Yes. And it took Steve Ballmer leaving to do that. I knew Satya when he was a mid-level executive, and he was of the probably 20 senior execs at Microsoft that had the gravitas to do this job. Satya was probably not the one you would have chosen.
Interesting.
There were lots of others, but they all eventually left to do other things because they got tired of waiting and, it wasn't going to happen for them. So they left. And that next tier of people, Satya was in that group, but still not one that you would say, oh, he's the obvious choice.
And yet, an excellent choice. He was at Azure, in the Azure group. And since that's become a big, you know, part of Microsoft's future, I think he understands the cloud better than maybe Steve Ballmer did.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
He definitely does.
Yeah.
Steve was a sales guy, but I got to tell you, I worked closely with Steve Ballmer, and he is a brilliant, passionate, visionary guy. He is amazing. People don't know that. They don't get close to him and see how he works, but no one works harder than Steve Ballmer. No one has more passion than Steve Ballmer. He's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
But ultimately, he was the one holding Microsoft back from the kinds of things that have happened since Satya took over.
Maybe not his fault. Maybe, as you point out, he's part of the old guard.
Right.
And in order for it, and this is a challenge to every company, and we'll talk about Google in a second, where you are now, that every company in technology has to face the innovator's dilemma. The founder isn't going to last forever. You've got to find a new way to survive as a company. You've got to reinvent yourself. Technology does not sit still. In fact, I think the business cycle for technology companies is a fraction of the length of the business cycle for a more traditional industrial company. Our guest is Don Dodge. I'm thrilled to have you on. He is a developer evangelist for Google and advocate for Google. We haven't even gotten to that part yet. And I also want to talk about that grim day in 2009 when you got your walking papers at Microsoft, but it has a happy ending.
Yes, it does.
And a moral. And I want you to talk a little bit about what you had learned and why it wasn't the end of the world. But first, a word from our sponsor. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. If you're when I was, you know, a solo entrepreneur, there was one part of the business I hated, and that was the business. I love what I do. I'm terrible at business. And for me, that meant at the end of the month, when it was time to send out invoices, I just would groan and moan, and sometimes I just wouldn't do it. And that's when I learned the very valuable lesson that I think every entrepreneur has learned. If you don't send out the invoices, you don't get paid. Fortunately, and this is 2004, there was a new startup out of Toronto. I was up there once a month to do a TV show in Toronto, and my co-host Amber MacArthur, she had to put up with this moaning and groaning at the end of every month. She said, Leo, there's a new company in town. You got to try it. It's called FreshBooks. And at the time, it was very Web 2.0. I remember she said, this Web 2.0, because you did your invoices on the web, but they were easy. They were fast. They did the currency conversion that was such a pain. In fact, they handle every kind of currency. The invoices get paid faster because... And I was still mailing paper invoices with FreshBooks, and I'm sure they still do that. But really nowadays, and even in 2004, the email invoice was what really worked because it had a button on it that said, you can pay Leo right now, press this button. And it turns out clients have the same problem paying bills as you have sending bills. It's just another chore. So making it easy meant I got paid faster. Using FreshBooks, you get paid on average 11 days faster. They have the stats. And here we are, 13 years later, FreshBooks has just gotten better and better and better. Their new dashboard, man, I love this. Brand new. It gives you quick access to everything. So in the process of making invoices and getting paid, you also, by the way, can use FreshBooks to keep track of expenses, to, you know, do expense reports, that kind of thing. You get a complete picture of your spending, your outstanding balances, your sales tax, your profit and loss. And most importantly, in a lot of small businesses, you'll know at any moment whether you're making money. A lot of times it's not till tax time you know if you had any profit. The new time tracking features make it so easy to bill. If you do hours, you bill by time. By client and by project, you just press play on the app or on the website to track your time to the minute, and then it goes right into your invoice automatically. So do the expenses. You can use the app to take pictures of receipts. You'll know which invoices have been sent, which invoices have been paid, which invoices have not been paid. You even know which invoices have been viewed, so they can't use that old, "Oh, I didn't get your invoice yet" line. It doesn't work. You can brand all the invoices, of course. They look beautifully professional with your logo. They're, you know, they look fantastic. You could, if you could set up recording invoices for yourself so you don't even have to sit down at the end of the month. But you can also, and a lot of clients go for this, believe it or not, have automatic payments too, so that the client and you both have it easy. You can send automatic payment reminders if somebody's slow to pay, or automatic late fees if you want. FreshBooks is awesome, and of course, it works with everything you already use: Stripe, Shopify, Gusto, Acuity, scheduling, whatever it is. New features are being added on a weekly basis. Take a look at the FreshBooks iOS app. You can now create and send estimates with it. Send invoices to multiple people in an organization. Just add them as secondary contacts. Get a detailed overview of client payments with a new payments collected report. Forbes. Now, remember, I started using this in 2004. Forbes named them in 2017. They put them on their small giants list. FreshBooks, 10 million customers now. They've done great. Try it free. I know you're going to love this. It's so easy to use. You're not in it for the accounting. Don can explain all of that for us because he has an accounting degree. You're in it. You're in it because you love what you do. Let FreshBooks do the bookkeeping. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. If you would, do me a favor, use the word triangulation in the how did you hear about us section. That way we get credit and you get a great 30-day free trial. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. Are you a coder, Don, or like, what do you do?
No. No, I'm not a coder, as you've pointed out several times.
I'm sorry to bring up
an accounting degree.
And a business degree.
Yeah, a business degree.
What do you think your chief skill is, though? What's your magic?
Well, it started with being able to understand very complex problems in software and business, and being able to relate those complex problems in language that people could understand.
Yes.
And to coalesce all of the problems and inputs and basically be a product manager and figure out what is the competition doing, what are the key attributes of their products, what do we need to do in our products, and then talking to customers and figuring out what do they really need. Yeah. So that's really where it all comes together. And my mentor at the time was Chuck Rosewatt. He also had an accounting degree and went on to be senior vice president, corporate vice president at Oracle, in charge of all of the database engineering. So it doesn't have to be a coder type engineer to lead engineering and lead product. It needs to be someone who understands customer needs and can translate them into product requirements that engineers can build.
I think that's a common misconception. Most, you know, people just think, well, somebody writes the program. And if you're using software you like, or you're using software you don't like, blame the product manager, because that's the person who interprets for the engineer and interprets for the user. You can articulate in both directions. And that is actually a very rare skill. It is.
It's harder than you might imagine. So there are some brilliant engineers and coders who understand technically how to solve a problem. And there are some brilliant marketing or advertising people that understand how to talk about the product once it's done. But being the product manager in the middle and figuring out what the competitive environment is, what the customer needs are, what the user experience needs to be, and then codifying that so that engineers can build it is a pretty tough job. I would point out that Sundar Pichai at Google was a product manager.
Yeah.
And now he's in charge of all of Google.
I would say the best entrepreneurs are, in fact, in equivalent to product managers. That they're often, you don't want the coder determining the direction of the company. Engineers have a great important skill set, but it isn't necessarily the wide ranging skill set you need to make. I think of something like Kevin Rose, who isn't really a coder. He's a good friend. He's in effect a product manager. He does startups. He starts companies, but that's in effect what he is. He's the guy who can articulate a vision so a coder can execute, and then articulate a marketing strategy so people understand what the product does. And that's a very that is what an entrepreneur does ultimately.
Right. And going back to Ray Ozzie, he's one of those rare individuals who was a brilliant software architect and coder, but also a brilliant product manager to understand what the product needed to be. It's very, very rare. And Ray Ozzie was one of those guys. Sundar Pichai is one of those guys. Right. Kevin Rose is a visionary, but not a coder.
It's a shame that Ray lacked that one skill he really needed, which is a political nose for politics and how to play it.
He had no patience for that kind of thing.
Smart people usually eschew politics. I'm not going to play that game. But sometimes that's the game that has to be played, and a big company really is. Google's an interesting story because Google clearly understands that and has worked very hard to stay a nimble, youthful company as they get larger. How do they do that?
Yeah, it's rare. So you have Larry Page and Sergey Brin, founders who are still at the company, but they have delegated authority to Sundar Pichai to run Google and to Diane Greene to run Google Cloud. And they have attracted these brilliant people to manage these different businesses under the Google umbrella or Alphabet umbrella today. And that's pretty rare. You don't see that happen very often.
Did Larry and before him Eric Schmidt see that as the challenge at Google is to find a structure that avoided the innovator's dilemma, that kept Google innovating and moving forward?
They were very aware of the innovator's dilemma. Yeah. And just for your audience, the innovator's dilemma, that was a book written by Clayton Christensen from Harvard Business School. And it's basically a book about how dominant companies in any industry eventually get disrupted by a tiny little startup doing something that is inferior and smaller and, you know, not of any consequence. But the innovator's dilemma is, do I switch gears and go to this new technology that's not as good, or do I double down on my existing business and go further up the stack for bigger customers? That's the dilemma. And startups, Clayton Christensen invented this term innovator's dilemma to describe how the small startup innovators often overtake these dominant companies. And it's happened over and over again. So Google was very aware of that and has taken steps to avoid the innovator's dilemma and to stay a nimble company, even with 80,000 employees.
It's clear when you go there or you talk to people, you get that feeling that that's really their goal. So I'm glad to get that confirmation that that was, and the way it's structured is interesting because you have to, everything is a startup at Google. Every idea, every product, every business is a startup, and you have to fight as you would if you were running your own little company. It's very interesting.
It's a good thing, and it's in contradiction to the way that Microsoft would do things. So Microsoft would do things in a very hierarchical way where the products had to line up with what Microsoft does. At Google, it's completely different, where everything is a startup and they work on their own. Android is an example. So Google was a search company at the time, had nothing to do with mobile phones or smartphones, but they had a vision and they knew that that was going to be the future of computing. So they bought Android and brought in Rich Miner and Andy, who were the founders of Android, and they went on to do brilliant things and make Android the most successful smartphone in the world. That would be very difficult to happen at Microsoft. In fact, it didn't happen.
No, because you can't cannibalize Windows. You can't hurt the Office business. The product managers over there, you know, the directors of those businesses would shut you down.
Right. And that is, in fact, the definition of the innovator's dilemma.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Even if it's within the company.
Sure. Yeah. You might remember Microsoft tried to do, they had Windows CE. That was their answer to smartphones. Windows CE, which was a smaller, more compact version of Windows to work on a mobile phone. That was, that's how Microsoft thought, where Google went entirely different direction and said, no, let's do an open source operating system that can be used anywhere on any platform. And they don't have to pay us, a big royalty, or they don't have to bundle Office with it. It's a completely different thing. So that's a perfect example of the innovators.
So it's one line in your Wikipedia biography. Dodge was laid off from Microsoft November 5th, 2009, and became developer advocate at Google. I have a feeling there's more to that story.
Well, there always is. I was laid off with 5,000 or almost 6,000 other people. So it wasn't a firing in the traditional sense where, you know, you're...
It wasn't personal.
No, it wasn't personal. Well, it was to me.
Yeah. But yeah, it's always personal.
But I was laid off with 5,000 or 6,000 other people at the time. But the end result is the same. You're gone. And not randomly. There were reasons. So I call it the Scoble effect.
I'm sure Robert appreciates that.
Well, you might remember that Robert Scoble also exited Microsoft kind of quietly and unceremoniously. But here's the effect, and here's what happened to me. The Scoble effect is when you are more famous than your boss or your boss's boss or your boss's boss's boss. These guys have egos, and, you know, they're smart guys, and they have thousands of people reporting to them, and they want to be the face of the company. So Robert got to a point where he was the face of the company, and there were some senior executives that weren't comfortable with that, and they wanted a piece of that. So Robert was sort of shuffled out. About a year later or 2 years later, the same thing happened to me. In my case, it was along with thousands of other people. But that was the reason. It was because I was the one on stage at TechCrunch Disrupt LearWeb or these huge tech conferences. I was the one writing the blog. I was the one that the report would contact for quotes and reactions to things. And it was okay for a few years, but after a while, some big egos were hurt, and it was time to move on.
However, it was to your benefit, just as it has been to Robert's, that you were that well-known, because if you're not, it's going to be pretty hard to get that next job. Nobody knows what you were doing, and you might be known inside the company, but you're not known outside the company. In fact, I think it's a great story because Mike Arrington at TechCrunch wrote about you getting laid off. Vic Gundotra at Google saw it and said, we should call this guy because you were well-known.
That's right. It all goes back to blogging, Leo. Blogging and speaking at conferences and that sort of thing. People knew who I was. So when it happened, when Microsoft decided to lay me off, it was kind of shocking to a lot of people, certainly to me. I had no idea. And Mike Arrington at TechCrunch, when he heard, he read my blog, actually. So the way it went down was that Microsoft called me on the phone. I was traveling at the time and said, hey, bad news, you're gone. And I said, okay, that's interesting. I wrote a blog post and said, well, you know, these things happen. And I had a great 5 years at Microsoft and loved the people there. But you know what? It's time to move on. And so I'll see what's next. Mike Arrington read my blog and wrote a post in TechCrunch. And then the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and San Francisco Chronicle and on and on and on it went. It just caught fire. And it was surreal.
That has to feel good, though. I think that has to feel really good.
It did.
It's vindicating.
My mother, who had no idea what I do, but my mother started reading this and she said, it sounds like you died and they're writing eulogies about you. It was surreal.
Yeah, yeah.
And because of that coverage and reaction, Google hired me. And I just saw our senior vice president at Google just a week ago. And he said, Don, you know, you are still the fastest hire in the history of Google.
Yeah. No, I mean, no notorious for 60 interviews before you can get a job, right?
Yeah, it usually takes 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
Mine was 3 days.
That's awesome. and really, that must have been exciting because, I mean, you look at your resume. I left off Compaq, by the way, but you look at your resume. What better company today to work for than Google?
Yeah, at the time when I looked around, it was Google, Facebook. That was about it.
Yeah.
Google, Facebook.
It's 2009. You couldn't put Apple in that group, probably.
No, not at that time.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you could.
The iPhone
right,
was
Leo.
Out, but just barely. Yeah.
Yeah, Apple was also on the list. So there might have been three companies that were like the premier companies to work for. And yeah, it was great. I've been at Google 8 years, and it was the best decision I ever made.
What do you so what do you do? What is a startup advocate?
Well, they on purpose call it a developer advocate.
Yeah.
At Microsoft, I was a technology evangelist, and Google just doesn't like that word evangelist. It sounds too salesy and too. You know, that's just not what we do.
So
we,
it was originated with Guy Kawasaki at Apple Computers. He was the first evangelist.
Exactly.
And when you're talking Apple, evangelist is the right word. Maybe not so much Google.
No, Google is just the opposite. Yeah. You know, to be Googly is to be technical and customer focused and not to be an evangelist. It's the products speak for themselves.
Yeah.
So my day job at Google is working with startups and developers and helping them be successful on Google platforms and using Google technology. It's speaking at conferences because that's a way to get to these founders and startups and technology leaders and even the press. So it's just a convenient way to do that. But that's how I spend most of my time. Either working directly with startups and developers or at conferences and talking with the public.
So it's really not very different from what you did at Microsoft.
It's actually identical to what I did at Microsoft. It's just a different title and a different way of doing it.
Right, right. Tell me about some of the things you're excited about right now. There's a lot to be. It's funny. I think we were going through a plateau until fairly recently in technology. And now I feel like between virtual and augmented reality and self-driving vehicles, and we're starting to get exciting again. Do you agree?
Yes, technology does go through cycles, but you know we're in the technology business, so we hear about things and the technology is starting long before the public really gets involved or knows about it. So things like self-driving cars, as an example, they've been on Google campuses for 4 years. I've been watching self-driving cars drive around the campus. So it's nothing new. Technology is always ahead of the market and the ability of the market and consumers to adopt them. So that's always the case if you're in the technology business. Self-driving cars are really great. Here's my take on self-driving cars. I think it's going to be like if you fly on an airplane, you probably don't know, but the computer is flying the airplane 95% of the time. The pilot is sitting in the seat, but the computer is flying the plane. And the pilot is there for the takeoff and the landing and in case anything goes wrong. I think cars are going to be the same. The self-driving cars work today, but people are not comfortable with losing that control. So I think you're going to see things like collision avoidance systems. You already see them. My Mercedes has a collision avoidance system, auto braking, like the car will start to brake if I get too close to another car or if I cross over a white line or yellow line, it will react. So I think what you're going to see is collision avoidance systems and self-parking, and it will be 90% automated, but you still need the driver there. Well, technically you don't need the driver there, but just people are not going to give up driving and not going to feel comfortable not driving for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. On the other hand, the key component of autonomous vehicles, machine learning and artificial intelligence, is happening everywhere, whether consumers know it or not. And I don't think they may not know it, but we're really at the beginning of an amazing transformation, I think, there.
That's the key. Machine learning and artificial intelligence, it's the core of everything that we're doing at Google now. It's affecting everything that we do. And you're right, most people are not aware of how pervasive it already is and how it's going to change lots and lots of things. And it is the core of self-driving cars.
Yeah. Well, we live in exciting times, and I think you have, I always say this about myself, ringside seats at the revolution. It's really fun to be in a position where you can, instead of doing one thing, kind of having a survey of everything that's happening, and boy, you've got a great seat at Google to watch that.
You know, Leo, that's the difference between being a startup entrepreneur and being a tech executive. If you're a startup entrepreneur, it's exciting, but it's very, very narrow.
Yeah.
You are totally focused on one thing and pretty much oblivious to anything else that's going on because you just don't have the time. If you're a tech exec, part of the job is being aware of everything that's going on and knowing a little bit about a lot of things. So, it is a ringside seat. It's an amazing place to be. It's an amazing time to be in technology, machine learning, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, all kinds of things happening in healthcare, machine learning applied to healthcare. It's just an amazing time.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Don, for you've been a part of this for almost as long as I have, really. It's 20 or almost 30 years now, and it's been
35.
It's been a fun run, and we're gonna keep going, right? We're not stopping.
No. It's just getting really exciting.
It's just getting exciting. Don Dodge is developer advocate at Google, and it's been a great pleasure talking to you, Don. Thanks for joining us today on Triangulation.
Thank you, Leo.
Take care. We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Well, yeah, we're going to stay at the same time, right? 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. As I mentioned, upcoming Triangulations will be a rotation between me, Jason Howell, and Megan Maroney. Who's next week? Is it Megan or Jason? Well, we'll find out. But I guarantee you, if you tune in at 11, there will always be something interesting to watch. Now, if you can't be here, and I know most of you can't, easy enough, we have on-demand audio and video of the show at our website, twit.tv/TRI. And, of course, the easiest way to get Triangulation is subscribe. Use your favorite podcast application and make sure you download each and every episode. You don't want to miss a single one. Thanks for being here, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.